Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How can science help us form more accurate perceptions and make better, more ethical decisions? Most of us feel pretty confident that we know and understand ourselves and that we're good at making judgments about the people and events in our lives. But as my guest today has learned over years of reporting on cutting-edge research, our brain's remarkable ability to make quick assessments can sometimes lead us to incorrect conclusions. And those conclusions might lead us to act in biased ways, even when we harbor no conscious feelings of animosity toward those who are different from us. Shankar Vedantam is science correspondent for NPR and author of the 2010 book The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Lives. He is in town to speak tonight at the Winspear Opera House as part of Dallas Faces Race, co-sponsored by TEDx, SMU, and KERA. And by the way, we are actually broadcasting this hour of the show from the KERA television studios, where today we have a small live audience with us. Shankar, welcome back to Think.
So happy to be here, Chris.
Great to have you. So if there is a unifying theme to your work, it's this element of surprise. Can you talk about why you think it's important that on a regular basis we go back and challenge the things we think we already know?
I think in some ways, Chris, it has to do with the fact that I myself consider myself to be a very rational person. And I think of everything that I do as being determined and conscious and intentional. And over the last 10 years or so, I've come by mountains of studies, warehouses of studies that suggest in everyday life I'm acting in ways that are biased, that are not rational. And to me, as a rational person, this seems profoundly problematic. I can't imagine that I'm acting in ways that are contrary to my best intentions, but there's abundant evidence that actually is the case. And so whenever I come by one of these studies or a new piece of research that suggests a new way in which human beings are biased, my first reaction is almost surprise at myself because I can't believe that I would succumb to those biases when in fact I do.
I think we all get drawn in by your enthusiasm for these stories. I wonder if you find the scientists that you interview are also really excited by the conclusions they never expected to make.
To some extent, I think many of the scientists actually might be less excited by the findings than I am, because I think many of them expect to find what they expect to find. A lot of them are working in specific domains. They've been looking at a piece of research for a long period of time. And so a new piece of finding, it's unlikely that it's going to be radically different from what they expect. But as I said, I think I come at this in some ways from a very rationalistic point of view. And so I'm constantly taken aback by the ways in which our minds lead us astray.
So you're here for Dallas Faces Race. And one of the things that you have explored over the years is the ways that our, what you call our hidden brain, affects our perceptions of ourselves and other people around us based on things like race and sex and gender.
That's right. So we use our hidden brains every day in all kinds of ways. From the time we wake up in the morning to brush our teeth to the time we go to sleep at night, much of our mental functioning is happening below the level of conscious awareness. If you actually were to wake up in the morning and pay really close conscious attention to every single thing you're doing, it would take you until the evening to even brush your teeth, because it really is very time consuming to think very deliberately about everything you do. And so what we do is we outsource much of our thinking to a part of our brains that handles everything that happens that doesn't need our conscious attention. So a lot of our lives are led on autopilot. Now, much of the time, the hidden brain plays a salutary role in our life. It's actually helpful to have this unconscious part of our mind handle many of the mundane things in life. The problem is the hidden brain also is sometimes active when we're making really important judgments, judgments about our future, about the lives of other people, about the well-being of other people. And it's at those times that biases can play a profoundly detrimental role in our judgments about how other people behave.
And this occurs even among people who not only don't want to hold biases, but don't believe they hold any biases.
Yeah, I think this is the thing that's really insidious about the hidden brain, which is that when we look at our behavior does not feel like it's manipulated in any way. When I look at my own behavior, I feel my behavior is conscious and intentional. As I've said, I feel like a rational human being. Here's the trick. When the hidden brain comes up with something and makes us do something in a certain way, it even covers its tracks. So it doesn't just manipulate us, but it covers its tracks after manipulating us. And you can go back and ask people why they did certain things, and people will come up with explanations for why they chose to go down path A rather than path B, they won't say, my hidden brain made me do it. They will invent reasons, conscious reasons, why they would have preferred path A rather than path B. This is especially the case in politics, for example. There's a lot of research showing unconscious biases shape how we think about political issues. But if you go in and drill down and you ask a voter, why do you believe this political issue rather than that, the voter will come up with a list of explanations and say, I disagree with this policy because of A, B, C, and D, when in fact it's unconscious bias that's driving the ship.
So like you, all of us believe we're rational people, and all of us occasionally can get led astray.
That's exactly right. And, you know, to be fair, much of the time this is happening in a way that is innocuous and not harmful. So we are making quick judgments about one another. As we're sitting here at KERA, I'm looking at you and paying attention to your facial expressions, and I'm reading your mind to pay attention to how interested you are in what I have to say. I'm going to modulate what I say in response to what you say. And so much of the time, this unconscious processing is very helpful. It helps us connect with other people, make good connections, understand what another person's mind is. So I'm not suggesting the hidden brain is always a malicious or a malevolent force in our lives. Much of the time it's helpful. There are times, though, it really leads us astray, and we have to be vigilant to those times.
So let's talk about race. First of all, how much does culture shape which races our hidden brains tend to favor or disapprove of, even if we're not actively aware of this?
So I think culture plays an enormous role in deciding how our hidden brains think about race. One thing I like to say is it's possible the brain comes with the hardware built in for bias. So we have the architecture for bias built into the brain by biology. But what the content of that bias is, what shape that bias takes, or which direction it leans, is shaped by the culture that we're in. So if you grow up in India, as I did, you're very likely to grow up with a different set of biases than if you grew up in the United States, because the culture in India teaches you different kinds of biases. It teaches you different people are in positions of power, or different people are in groups that don't have power, and your hidden brain learns and assimilates those things. So the culture is absolutely essential in determining how the hidden brain reaches the specific biases it has.
What's really astonishing is how early this starts to happen. Even babies show signs of hidden bias.
That's right. So these biases seem to be evident as early as psychologists are able to measure them. So the earliest that you can actually conduct experiments with a child without having the child wander off, you know, the child has to be 2 or 3 years old. And by the time children are 2 or 3, they are showing at a robust level these biases in all kinds of domains, when it comes to race, when it comes to gender, when it comes to deciding who is good, who is bad, who is clean, who is dirty. Children are making these quick, automatic judgments, often without anyone actually explicitly teaching them to say, this group is good or this group is bad.
So less people start to feel like we're powerless to do anything about this. Essentially, we are capable of being aware of these things and acting according to our values rather than according to our sort of deeply seated prejudices.
Yeah, it is possible, I think, to become aware of it. But here's the catch, Chris, which is that because these biases lie in the unconscious mind, they lie in the hidden brain, we are not aware of these biases when we look into our hearts. So when I look into my own heart, I don't feel like I'm biased in any way. I feel I'm making judgments about everyone that are fair and accurate, that I'm seeing reality for what it is. Now, I know after all this work and research over the last 10 years, that's not what my brain is doing. My brain is biased in all kinds of different ways. But when I introspect, my brain feels like it's a clean machine. My brain feels as if it is not biased. And so one of the challenges when we're thinking about these unconscious biases is that we have to rely not so much on introspection and how we feel about ourselves, but on our actions. What are we actually doing? Are our actions actually fair, or are our actions biased? And when we recognize that our actions are at odds with our intentions, then there's something that we can do about it, because we then recognize there's something inside me that's making me move in a direction that I don't actually intend.
One thing I love about talking about our biases in this way is that it allows us to acknowledge that they exist in all of us, and it sort of gives us a path around that defensiveness that so many people feel when you sit down and try to have, even among well-intentioned people, an honest conversation about race. Because everybody wants to be the first to say, all of you people have a problem. I hold no biases, but I want to be part of the solution.
That's right. And I think this is one of the unintentional costs in some ways of how we have conceived and thought about race in America over the last 20 or 30 years, which is that because race has, thinking about race has moral values, it has a moral dimension to it, our conversations about race and racial prejudice have taken a very moral tone. You know, so when you accuse somebody of being racially biased, people perceive it as being an attack on them because you're accusing that person of not being a good person. Now, what the unconscious bias literature suggests is that large majorities of Americans, upwards of 80%, 90% of Americans, are acting in these biased ways. And so part of the problem is because the way we've talked about race is in this very defensive posture, as you point out, it's made it very difficult for us to actually say, I might actually be a part of the problem, not just a part of the solution.
How does unconscious bias play out in cultures where the population is pretty homogenous and there is not a lot of racial diversity?
So our hidden brain sort of is not just interested in one dimension of how we judge other human beings. We are very adept at judging human beings in all kinds of different domains, and we're doing this very quickly. So, for example, when I grew up in India, religion was a really big deal, and which religion you belong to helped people categorize and place you. The caste system in India was very powerful, and people would judge you very quickly by your last name and a certain which caste you happen to be belonging in. So different cultures, the issue of race might not be as salient in a culture which is ethnically homogenous, but there are going to be other dimensions in those cultures, issues of socioeconomic difference or religion, sexual orientation. We are adept at categorizing human beings in hundreds of different ways. And, you know, the old joke, you put three people into a room and they'll find two different ways to form groups with one another. And I think that's true for human beings in general.
So there's no way around this in some way.
I don't think there's a way to get rid of these biases altogether. So I think the idea of having brains that are uncontaminated by bias is probably a fantasy. I think what is doable is to become aware of what those biases are in each of us, and then to try and find ways to actually steer the ship in a more accurate way. Now, this is not easy to do, Chris. And I remember when I was a kid, we would sometimes play a game when we were riding on a bicycle where we would switch our hands. So your right hand would hold the left handlebar, and your left hand would hold the right handlebar. And it's really difficult to ride a bike this way because you're used to pulling your hands in a certain direction as you're steering. And what you have to do when you switch is you have to ride the bike consciously. You can't let your hidden brain ride the bike anymore, because if you let your hidden brain ride the bike, you're going to crash. And by switching your hands, you actually have to say, I'm really paying attention to how I move the handlebars, and I'm doing it deliberately. And the same analogy in some ways functions when it comes to bias, that when we understand what our biases are, we might sometimes have to act in ways that feel a little unnatural, that don't feel intuitively correct, but in fact are producing the results and behaviors that are consistent with our values.
So we ought to focus on results rather than what it takes to get there.
I think so. I think a lot of the focus that we've often had when we've talked about race or talked about prejudice has focused on intention and has focused on how people feel. And it's not unimportant, and it certainly, I think, has bearing when we're speaking about conscious prejudice. So conscious prejudice exists. You know, people have conscious animosities toward people from other groups. And I think in those cases, it's very useful to think about your intentions and to ask yourself, are my intentions accurate? Am I being fair to other people? Am I being kind to other people? When it comes to the hidden brain, though, asking about intentions doesn't really make sense, because we're not aware of how our hidden brains are actually manipulating us.
We are speaking this hour with Shankar Vedantam, NPR science correspondent and author of the 2010 book, The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. He's in town to speak tonight at the Winspear Opera House as part of Dallas Faces Race, sponsored by TEDxSMU and KERA. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us now at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to NPR science correspondent Shankar Vedantam, author of the 2010 book The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. He's in town to speak tonight at the Winspear Opera House as part of Dallas Faces Race. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Shankar, I was fascinated by a piece you did a couple of months ago for NPR on the ways that Americans' racial identities tend to change over time, not only the way they identify themselves, but the way others see them, even though obviously they are the same person from the same place that they've been all along. Talk about what you learned.
Well, there's been a lot of research looking at how it is we come to think and understand how race actually functions. And so when I look at you, how do I make a quick judgment about what race you belong to? Much of the time, this is not happening consciously. I'm not even thinking about it consciously. But my hidden brain in some way supplies that answer. So this was the story I did for NPR. I looked at the work of a sociologist at Stanford called Aliyah Saperstein. And what she did was really simple. She looked at the ways people's race had been categorized in a massive national survey that the federal government conducts every year. And the survey tracks the same people over time. So it goes back and asks them periodically, tell us everything that's happened in your life. Have you gotten a job? Have you gotten married? Have you gotten divorced? Have you been to jail? It asks them a whole bunch of questions about their lives. And then it does two things. The interviewer categorizes the person's race. And so the interviewer says, I was speaking to a white person or a black person and so on. And in some versions of the survey, the respondent himself or herself also categorizes his or her race. And what Saperstein noticed was something really interesting. After people experienced a downward change in their social status, if they went on welfare, for example, or if they went to prison, they became more likely to be categorized as African-American. And when they experienced an upward change in their mobility, they became more likely to be categorized as white. Now, this complicates our idea of how we think about race, because usually when we think about race, we say race is just about skin tone and facial features, and it's all on the surface. It's just what you see. And what Saperstein's work, which is supported by a number of other pieces of research, suggests is that race actually is a much more complex phenomenon. It's actually constructed not just by biological characteristics, but by a whole bunch of social characteristics. And the reason this is really fascinating is that so many of our statistics and so many of our policies, our public policies, are driven on notions that we can actually categorize race in very fixed ways. That when we are following, for example, educational outcomes, the group that we're defining as white is going to be the same group that we're defining as white 5 years from now. And Saperstein's work suggests that might not actually be the case. The groups themselves and how they're categorized might itself be in flux, and it's driven, might be driven by our unconscious biases.
How do children start to form a racial identity, and how much does that have to do with the people around them?
You know, so this has been a big puzzle in the social science literature, because when you look at children who are 3 and 4 years old, they will robustly show biases that are very similar to the culture at large, to the culture of people who are in their 20s and 30s and 40s. And I think the conventional way, again, we've thought about this is we say, well, these children must be growing up in prejudiced households. Their parents must be teaching them that race A is good and race B is bad, because how else would a child who's 3 years old form these beliefs? And there's been some systematic work, a lot of it done in Canada, actually, that I describe in my book, just looking at whether that actually is true. So is it the case that teachers and parents and communities are teaching children biased messages? And the answer really is no. The idea is that these children are forming these biases really without anyone intending to give them a bias. In fact, that teachers and parents are actually trying to do exactly the opposite. They're trying to raise children to be tolerant and friendly and welcoming of all groups, but these children are forming the biases themselves. And the best explanation so far is that just as you're learning a language from age 0 to 2, or you're learning how to walk, you're learning all kinds of things, you're also learning how to categorize the world. When you walk in the park, your unconscious mind is paying attention to who is dressed well and who is homeless. Your unconscious mind is paying attention attention to who is on television shown in a suit and who is on television shown in a prison jumpsuit. And your unconscious mind is taking in all that information and it's making inferences saying this group is more likely to be a group that has higher social status and this group is likely to have lower social status.
So there was a test developed at Harvard to look at implicit associations, and we had one of the researchers on the show. I know that you've spoken to both of them. I actually went online and took one of those tests and was stunned to discover that my sort of hidden brain associates men with the workplace and women with the home. I am the daughter of a working mother. I'm a working parent myself. I hope that my daughters grow up and love their careers. Our CEO is a woman. What's gone wrong here that causes me not to think in the back of my mind the way that I live my life?
You know, I've taken that same test, Chris, and I've actually taken it about 200 times.
to get the right results?
In the hope that with practice, right. I'm actually going to get better. And that test result has always been the same every one of those 200 times I've taken the test. And I also think of myself as being a feminist. I'm very strongly in favor of, you know, women's equality and gender equality. And it dismays me that my hidden brain does not share the values and intentions of my conscious brain. And I think really what this speaks to is the fact that our minds are taking in information in two completely different ways. So at a conscious level, if I ask you, do you believe that women should be equal or have the right to advance in the workplace? Your conscious mind is going to say, well, of course they should, because that's what you consciously believe. Your hidden brain, unfortunately, has learned a different message, because over the course of your lifetime, you've seen tens of thousands of images or tens of thousands of stories or movies that look and describe men and women in different ways, that describe women in much more domestic ways, that show women in the household, that when they're in professional settings, they're often talking about men or talking about relationships, whereas men are shown in professional settings and in professional ways, and our unconscious minds have learned different rules than our conscious minds have learned.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Dan in Fort Worth. Hi, Dan.
Hi. My wife and my sister have recently signed up for the Affordable Care Act, and of course we think it's a great idea, but you've probably heard these stories about people, whenever they hear the Affordable Care Act couched as Obamacare, then suddenly it's an awful idea. And my own opinion, of course, is that's a sign of our, you know, unrecognized racism that we carry around with us in some cases. And I was wondering, if you were the president of the United States, you were President Obama, and you were an advisor to him, and you were trying to figure out the best way that he could sell this program, which I think is so important for the country, what advice would you give a politician who's faced with these biases that we really seem to have such trouble with?
Thanks for your call, Dan.
Well, Dan asks a really difficult and important question. And in fact, there's a lot of social science research to back up what Dan is saying. There's been work, for example, that looks at what happens when you tell people that the Affordable Care Act is a plan advanced by Barack Obama versus when you tell them the very same Affordable Care Act is a plan advanced by Bill Clinton. So in both cases, the plan is being advanced by a Democratic president, but in one case, the president is white, in one case, the president is black. The plan itself is identical in both situations. What we find is there are divergences, that people are more likely to support the Affordable Care Act when it's perceived as a Bill Clinton plan compared to when it's a Barack Obama plan.
Except during the Clinton presidency, I guess.
Well, that's right. And so these biases cut in different ways, and Clinton may have been victim to a whole set of different biases, not just when it comes to race. It's also the case that while it's certainly true that whites are more likely to be against the Affordable Care Act when it's defined as Obamacare, the reverse is true for African Americans. It turns out African Americans are more likely to support the Affordable Care Act when it's called Obamacare, because they are biased in favor of a black president. And so these biases cut both ways. They're not just cutting in favor of, you know, whites against blacks, but it's also how blacks are thinking about these issues. What's interesting is that in all these cases, people are not aware that their racial attitudes are shaping how they think about a public policy. If you ask them, why do you oppose the act or why do you support it, people will come up with a list of very explicit answers, and they sincerely believe that that's the reason why they support or oppose the act. Now, from the point of view of a president, Dan's question was, what would you advise a president? This is a really tricky thing, because it's very difficult to go up to people and say, I believe that your attitudes about this public policy are shaped by your unconscious attitudes about race, because people are going to say, no, that's not what's driving it. I sincerely believe the Affordable Care Act is a disaster. I sincerely believe it's a wonderful idea. In many ways, a lot of the social science research suggests that it's more effective to come at the issue sideways than to come at it head on, to actually come at it in a way that basically tries to take race off the table rather than confronting people and saying, it's your racial attitudes that are making you biased against Obamacare, or it's your racial attitudes that make you for Obamacare. In some ways, it's actually more helpful to try and find ways to take race off the table completely so that it's actually not a factor in the conversation and say, how is the Affordable Care affecting you? How is it? Let's break this down and talk about the finances of your family. How are you personally going to be affected? How much more would you pay? What's the cost to you? And in some ways, when you think about this in a very conscious way, when you think about the pluses and minuses as it affects you financially, in some ways you manage to ease, or you might be able to ease race a little bit off the table.
Is there a reason why people are more likely to make strong classifications according to factors like race and sex, as opposed to things like class? For example, shouldn't all middle-class people relate to one another and have the same issues? And shouldn't all people who are, the working poor relate to one another across a stronger, in a stronger way than they would as classed simply by race?
Yeah, I think what's interesting, Chris, is that it's not only the case that some issues might be a little bit more salient than others, but none of these issues are, none of these issues work all by themselves.
Right.
So there's no one's brain that only thinks about race, and there's no one's brain that only thinks about class. What's really happening at any given time is that your unconscious mind is processing all of these things simultaneously. And your attitudes about race are shaping how you think about class, and your attitudes about class are shaping how you think about money. Your attitudes about money are shaping how you think about sexual orientation. These are completely divergent topics, but in our minds, these are all intersecting topics. And there's a whole field in social science called intersectionality, which looks at how these ideas intersect with one another. I think there are times when economic issues and socioeconomic issues do in fact take precedence in our lives and will in fact become more salient. I think when you have an African-American president in the White House and race is often on the table in public conversation, it's a little bit easier for race to become a more salient part of the conversation than socioeconomic issues.
So we had a question during the break from our live studio audience about this phenomenon that I think makes a lot of us very uncomfortable, and that is that sometimes people tend to find it easier to differentiate facial features among members of the racial or ethnic group they are most familiar with.
Yes, and I think this is a distressing issue for many members of minority groups because they often feel that they're invisible, that people feel that I can mistake you for somebody who looks like you but just happens to be of the same race. And here's the thing. I think what's devilish about this is that this is not happening because the people making the mistakes are bad people. So again, the way we think about these issues first is often to think about it in a very judgmental fashion and say that somebody who mistakes two people belonging to the same race as being identical to one another, that must reflect there's something bad about you, or that you have animosity in your heart toward those people. What's really happening is that our minds are just much more adept at doing certain things because we've had much more practice in doing those things than it is in doing other things. I'm very good at riding a bicycle because I've ridden a bicycle for many, many years. You put me on a pair of roller skates or rollerblades, I'm going to be unsteady because it's just not something that I've done. When it comes to classifications of race and classifications of facial features, your familiarity with the group does predict how easily you're able to distinguish small differences between different faces. So when I look at fish, for example, if I look at goldfish, all goldfish look exactly identical to me, because I don't spend much of my life with goldfish. I look at a goldfish, goldfish tank once every 3 months in an aquarium. But if I lived among goldfish, and if I had a whole bunch of pets who were goldfish, those fish with time would start to look very different from one another, and each of them would have their own personality. I would distinguish between them. And if someone came and said, all those goldfish look identical, I would say, no, they all are completely different. So our familiarity with faces really determines how easily we are able to distinguish between faces. At the same time, if you're a member of a minority group and you're being mistaken for someone else, it's painful because you feel like your individuality in some ways has been erased.
Is there something people can do about this when it happens to them? Is there a polite way to sort of call somebody out on this?
You know, again, I'm not sure the issue is calling someone out, because I think when people make this mistake, the people who are making the mistake are often mortified when they find out that they have made this mistake. Mm-hmm. It's not as if they say, well, I've just mistaken two people and I don't really care that I did that because I don't care about these two people. People are actually really upset that they've made the mistake. And so they actually, people want to do the right thing. I think one of the things that I have picked up in the last 10 years is that we actually underestimate how many people want to do the right thing. When we're thinking about prejudice and discrimination, it's very important, of course, to think about conscious prejudice and think about disparities. It's also important to remember the asset that we have, which is large numbers of people don't want to act in prejudiced ways. Large numbers of people want to do the right thing.
So you're saying we can be trying our best and still failing. So again, we have to come back and look at results rather than intentions.
Yes. And to think about it as any other skill that we're learning. So, for example, if I'm learning how to rollerblade, you wouldn't be surprised the first 20 times I tried it if I fell. And you would say, well, that's just part of what it takes to learn how to rollerblade. What you have to do is get up on your feet and try once again, or try and do it this way, or try and manipulate your legs or bend your knees a little bit. You would give me very concrete, specific advice that basically says, this is a skill that can be learned, and it's a skill that can be mastered with practice. We don't think about our interpersonal relationships the same way, when in fact they are exactly the same. Our ability to relate to one another, our ability to make judgments about one another, these are skills, and these are skills that can be mastered and learned with practice.
And they're certainly worth the effort.
I would think so. I mean, it's possible that there are people who say, I really don't care about gender equality, I don't care about racial equality, I'm happy to be acting in a biased way. And in some ways, much of the work that I have done doesn't really speak to that group of people. I don't really, you know, I'm not really interested in the group of people who say, I'm okay with being biased or I'm okay with being prejudiced. I'm much more interested in the majority of people, the 70, 80, 90% of Americans who say, I don't want to be biased, I don't believe I am biased, but in their practice, in their actions, they actually are biased.
Another question we've had is about the role of meditation or mindfulness in working on these skills.
There's been some interesting work looking at mindfulness that basically suggests that being mindful is in fact what it is that you're trying to do. So in many of these interactions, what's really happening is you are distracted by some task and you're trying to make a very quick judgment about someone, or you're trying to remember someone's name in a very quick, high-pressure situation, and your conscious mind has its hands full, to mix a couple of metaphors there. And what happens is your hidden brain essentially supplies the answer. The analogy I've sometimes given is that imagine that the conscious brain is like the pilot of the plane and the hidden brain is like the autopilot function on the plane. When the pilot is really busy and has his or her hands full and is distracted by doing something, someone has to fly the plane. And that's when the autopilot function takes over. And so being mindful might actually be a way to actually take the controls back to say, I'm the one who's actually flying the plane.
NPR science correspondent Shankar Vedantam is my guest. He's in town to speak tonight at the Winspear Opera House as part of Dallas Faces Race, sponsored by TEDxSMU and KERA. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with NPR science correspondent Shankar Vedantam, who's in town to speak tonight at the Winspear Opera House as part of Dallas Faces Race, sponsored by KERA and TEDxSMU. He's the author of the 2010 book, The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Sarah on the line in Denton. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thank you both for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
My call is about our kids, and pardon me, I'm wondering at what age our children's hidden brains begin to develop that separation between the races or socioeconomic demographic or even sexual preference, and what can we as parents do to positively reinforce the integration of all of our friends and family members and things like that, so that society's idea of separation between races and things like that can be prevented.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Sarah. That's a great question, and it's something that I think a lot of parents are thinking about. I think in some ways the research is better at telling us what we shouldn't be doing as it is about telling us what we should be doing. So one thing that a lot of parents do, and as a parent myself, I know that I'm guilty of this too, is that we're often hesitant to put issues such as race or gender or sexual orientation or prejudice on the table because we fear that it will prompt our children to adopt attitudes or form beliefs or even become aware of things that we don't want them to be aware of, that we'd like to have them grow up without being contaminated in some ways by these attitudes and prejudice. The problem is this doesn't take into account that our children are actually absorbing information at a furious pace from the culture at large, because that's what our brains do. Our brains are, you know, these absorbers of information, and especially in early childhood from age 0 to 2, the amount of information and data that you're taking in is just staggering. And so the odd thing is, as parents, we are actually taking the one way we can influence our children off the table when we don't discuss race, when we don't discuss prejudice. And I think the hard thing to do, but the better thing to do, is actually to put it on the table, to actually say, well, why do you think it is that every president that we see is a guy? Is there a rule that only men can be presidents? And I think for very young children, it actually is super helpful to actually make it clear that there isn't a rule that only men can be presidents. Because when you're 2 and 3, you haven't really developed the ability to form very logical inferences about the world. It is not irrational to assume that only men can be presidents, because we've had 44 of them, and all of them have been men. And so in some ways, for very young children, it's helpful to put ideas on the table. As children get older, they develop more sophisticated ways of thinking about patterns and logic, but you also have very strong tendencies that drive people into groups where people are seeking their friends and what sociologists call homophily, or clustering with people who are like-minded. And in some ways, it takes a very, you know, very steady and consistent effort to try and push against that current, because left to ourselves, without anyone actually making us biased, our brains are going to develop these biases from a very young age, and we're going to act on them. In some ways, what the message of my book is that we have to become aware of these biases and then push against it constantly. There's no one magic button that can be pressed that eliminates bias from our brain. It's really this constant struggle of pushing in some ways against the patterns in which the culture is pushing us.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Melissa on the line in Richardson. Hi, Melissa.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Yes, he just spoke briefly. He touched on kind of the answer to my question or comment, but I was just wondering if there have been any studies over time that look at the change in people's stereotypes or biases on gender or race based on the media, given that our access to the media has changed so much over the last 50 or 60 years.
Well, I think there has been some research that does suggest there have been changes. I have actually very little doubt that there probably have been profound changes in the United States compared to 50 years ago. I mean, I think there's probably much less unconscious prejudice today than there was 50 years ago, because we're seeing many counter-stereotypical examples around us all the time. We have an African-American man who's a president, and that's a first. And as our hidden brains look out at the world and they see women in professional settings and they see counter-stereotypical examples to the way that we've traditionally thought, our hidden brains will change and adapt. There's also been some interesting work looking at matriarchal societies, for example, and suggesting the biases there could be the mirror image of the biases that we have in our societies, that when you have a society where only women are allowed to have the jobs, or women are allowed to advance or be the political leaders, our hidden brains learn the message that women are naturally supposed to be the leaders. Just like in Western countries, in the United States, we've traditionally learned that leadership is a masculine activity. So there's very little doubt in my mind that as culture changes, our hidden brains will change as well. The thing to keep in mind, of course, is the culture changes at a somewhat glacial pace. So if we were to wait for the culture to change before we free our minds of these biases, we're going to be waiting for a very long time.
You and I both work in newsrooms, which are environments where diversity is really prized. And people might look from the outside and think that's because you have to put one in column A and one in column B. But honestly, it's often because you can sort of get a different idea about the world and what's going on if you have different kinds of people. Can you talk about how living and working in diverse environments tends to shape people's hidden brains and affect the way we see those around us?
There's a huge literature on this, and it wouldn't be possible to sort of encapsulate everything, but I think one of the ideas that a lot of this research suggests is that working with people with different backgrounds helps you think about and see the world in ways that are different. And I'll give you a couple of examples. There was a very interesting series of experiments conducted, I believe, by a social scientist at Princeton University. It may have been Yale, where he conducted mock juries, where he basically said, I'm asking people to evaluate a case, a trial, and you have to make a judgment about whether a person is guilty or innocent. And the jurors were not allowed to ask questions, and they were not allowed to talk amongst themselves. All he was trying to ask was, does the composition of the jury and the diversity of the jury, just the sheer presence of diversity, does it change how people think? And he found remarkably that when you had a diverse group of people sitting around a table, without any conversation happening between that group of people, everyone around that table started to anticipate views that might be different than their own. Mm. They were able to present, when asked to present views, they were able to present views that were much more complex, that involved much more shades of gray and much more nuance. It's an example of how just the sheer presence of diversity itself can potentially change the complexity with which people think about issues. I did another recent story for NPR looking at diversity and scientific collaborations recently, and it found that when scientific teams are comprised of people who come from diverse backgrounds, those scientific products, the papers and studies that come from them, tend to have greater impact in the field. So other scientists look at those papers and say, this is a paper that actually is a game changer. This is more likely to be a breakthrough. It seems, again, that when you bring people together from different walks of life, different perspectives, different geographic areas, you know, diversity is not just about race and gender. It could be about geographic areas. It could be about socioeconomic issues. The more perspectives you have working on an issue, the richer that product is going to be.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to, I think it's Hallen in Trophy Club. Hi, Hallen.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really like your guest. I'm very impressed by him having an MA in psychology and being a big fan of Sigmund Freud. I see his talk of the conscious and the unconscious mind much in the same way that the iceberg, as I'm sure that your guest knows, is used to represent that as a kind of a metaphor, with the conscious mind being just the tip of the iceberg, and then underneath is the unconscious mind. What I like about your guest is that we're not bringing the individual to the couch to look at the unconscious mind, but we're looking at the universal patient, so to speak.
Well, thanks so much for your call. I'm sure you're delighted by the compliment, but this is a little bit different, we should say, than the Freudian theory of the unconscious.
I think it is. And, you know, just to clarify, I don't actually have an academic background in psychology. This is driven more by my journalistic interest and the fact that I've been covering these issues for many years. But I think thinking about the unconscious mind in the way that social scientists have been thinking about it the last 10 or 15 years is somewhat different from the Freudian view of the unconscious mind. For one thing, there are not the same theories about what's causing the unconscious mind to behave in the ways it does. So where Freud saw the unconscious as being actually a source of intention, a source of, you know, drama and passion and hidden urges, the unconscious mind that's been painted in the literature the last 10 or 15 years is much more mundane. It's much more, we follow a rule. We see a whole bunch of guys being president, and we form an unconscious rule that only guys can be president. In many ways, it's a much more ordinary view of how the unconscious mind works, and it's also driven very strongly by measurement, by how do we actually measure what's going on, how do we actually add scientific heft to what's going on. And I think in some ways, I think it's informed, I think the analogy with Freud, I think, is exactly right with terms of the iceberg, which is that it seems the more we learn about the unconscious mind, it seems that the more and more it is that what our brains do is mostly unconscious. And in fact, one of the really provocative questions that I've come by as I've thought about these issues in many years is not so much why do we need a hidden brain, But why do we need a conscious brain? If our hidden brain can actually accomplish or do 90 or 95% of the things that we need to do in our everyday life, what is the evolutionary advantage of actually having a conscious mind? And this, believe it or not, is actually a serious question that people are trying to address.
Well, that's why we have radio shows. We wouldn't be able to do all these things, right, if we didn't have these conscious minds that can think about the future. That's one thing that we do that it appears animals don't do in the same way.
It's possible. It's also possible the hidden brain actually does a lot of thinking about the future. It's making judgments about risk, for example. A lot of our perceptions about risk, which is very much about what happens in the future, are shaped by our unconscious minds. Again, the illusion is that everything that our minds do is conscious. But when I'm looking at you, I'm not really understanding how my thoughts are forming words. I don't really understand how I listen to a question that you ask me, and that question forms meaning inside my brain, and I formulate a response. All of this is happening on the fly, and I'm not aware of it. I think it's conscious, but when I actually look into my brain and say, how do I understand what Chris just asked me? How do I know what Chris's intentions are as I'm trying to read Chris's eyes? All of this is happening below the level of conscious awareness. It's all happening in unconscious processing.
Have you looked at animal research into at least the animals that interact with humans on a regular basis? Because it does seem that dogs sort of form these broad categories of people. You know, you've met dogs that are scared of men but like women, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and you know, this is the other thing that human beings do, because we are so skilled at reading other people's minds, is that we sometimes read minds into things that actually don't quite work the same way we do. And I believe that pet owners are really guilty of this.
Anthropomorphism.
Yeah, so when we look at our dog, we sort of say the dog has a close relationship to us. Well, maybe. It's also possible
it's
the dog
hungry.
Yeah, the dog could just be hungry, right? The dog could just want safety. The dog could just want a home. We don't quite understand what it is to be inside a dog's brain. And yet, because we are so skilled at reading other people's minds, and this skill helps us form connections with other people. So as I'm looking into your eyes, Chris, I'm sort of gleaning from you the way you're looking at me that you're interested in what I'm saying, and I'm drawing a mental picture of what's happening in your mind. Now, my mental picture of what's happening in your mind might be completely wrong, but it really helps me form a relationship with you, to talk to you, to make a connection with you. And we do the same thing all the time with not only things that are in the non-human world, but things that are in the non-animate world. So when we see cars that have headlights and a front grille that's in the shape of a human smile that looks human-like, or we see a mouse with big ears and eyes in front and a big smile, as, you know, Mickey Mouse does, we form bonds with these creatures because we imagine that their minds are similar to ours, when in fact, they're not at all.
Are you still making time to write short stories and plays?
You know, I really should make the time. I find that I don't really have the time anymore to do very much by way of creative writing. But something really interesting happens when I sort of sit down and actually spend 2 or 3 hours doing creative writing, because it forces you to get into a mind of someone who's actually completely different, a character or a situation. And I find that's really liberating in some ways, because it really broadens your perspective. So separate from, you know, any value that anyone else might get from your creative writing, I think the act of creative writing is so wonderful because it actually transports you into another world.
And then I suppose also has a beneficial impact on the nonfiction stuff you're doing.
Yes, I think in some ways the nonfiction stuff has taken over, partly because there's just this flood of information that's coming my way all the time, and so much of it is so fascinating that I find that I can't take my eyes off of it. I've often struggled to find ways to balance in my own life, you know, the issues of how much you want to spend on creative activity versus, you know, prosaic and practical activity. I know you had a guest just recently talking about being overwhelmed. I feel overwhelmed all the time.
Well, it never shows, which is a good thing.
Thank you, Chris.
Shankar Vedantam is science correspondent for NPR and author of the 2010 book, The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. He's in town to speak tonight at the Winspear Opera House as part of Dallas Faces Race. That event is co-sponsored by KERA and TEDxSMU. And Shankar, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been a delight, Chris.
We also want to thank our live studio audience here at KERA. Greatly appreciate your presence. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phone today from Katie Daniel. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.